So, welcome back. Or whatever is going on. Coming, going. Stop over. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 9. And we're going to be discussing text number 14. Yesterday morning, we discussed the end of chapter 8, and we landed on texts 5 and 6. This chapter is titled Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy. And the beginning verses are exactly that. Brahma is, first of all, acknowledging the mercy of the personality of God who just appeared before him. The darshan of the Lord was described at the end of the previous chapter. He is really clear about what his position is as a servant, and he's very clear about what his service is. It's to create a universe. And he's expressing his gratitude to the personality of Godhead for investing him with that power, that potency. And he's wishing to proceed. Although he has the potency to create, he's wishing for the Lord to guide him in the execution of this service. And to stay out of false ego, to stay always, to remain always protected in the position of being the Lord's instrument, nimitta. He ends by saying those that forget the position of being nimitta, or an instrument, get caught up in the mistaken conception of I and mine. So, with the conception of doership, I'm the doer, forgetting we're the instrument of the real doer. In the doership mentality, we become attached to the fruits of our work. Fruitive work is to get the carrot at the end, the product of the fruits of our work. And then considering the product of the fruits of our work, as we created it, to be ours. And with that brings a life full of anxieties, along with forgetfulness of a real identity, a real position, a real happiness. So that's where we ended. Just a quick summary of the next several verses, 7 through 10. Lord Brahma details the misfortune, the great misfortune of those that are not Krishna conscious, those that are in fruitive mentality, material consciousness. And then he goes back to the position of one who's in devotion. A very nice verse. I'm going to read text 11. O my Lord, your devotees can see you through the ears by the process of bona fide hearing, and thus their hearts become cleansed. And You take your seat there. You are so merciful to your devotees that you manifest yourself in the particular eternal form of transcendence in which they always think of you. So, that's a very nice verse. And a very nice purport. Long purport. Where in contrast to the complexities of material existence, those that wish instead to be connected to the personality of Godhead, the Supreme Lord reciprocates through sound vibration initially, and then through sound vibration there's a sequence that, of course, it's fast forward, but hearing becomes a medium of seeing. First hear through the ears. That's a very different procedure than most people follow, because we so much value our eyes for seeing, but then analyze, and our eyes are quite defective, largely because the eyes are equipped to see material, because we see with these material eyes, we can see matter only. And even the matter that we see, we see the matter because of our consciousness disconnected from the Supreme. So it's faulty seeing, and it fosters more illusion. So the Vedic system instead prefers the process of seeing through the ears. That's a nice, unique conception, seeing through the ears. Hare Krishna. Seeing through the ears allows, through that sound vibration, cleansing of the seat of consciousness, cleansing the material conceptions like Cheto, Darpana, Marjanam, mirror of the mind, or consciousness becomes cleansed by that sound vibration. And then, as the just like cleansing a mirror, then you can see a reflection. Even you have a nice mirror, if it's all covered, you can't see your reflection. But when the cleansing takes place, you can see yourself and simultaneously the source of yourself, or that with the common example Prabhupada gives is, at night you cannot see yourself, but during the daytime you can see the light of the sun and you can see yourself at the same time. They're simultaneous. So implied here is self-realization and God-realization takes place. One can see the form of the Lord because he's very merciful. He can't be seen other than his disclosure. But he, for those who are undergoing the process of cleansing, he shows himself, and he does so specifically, it's mentioned. He takes his place in the seat of the cleansed heart, and he further mercifully accepts that form, or exhibits that eternal form according to the meditation upon him. So some see the Paramatma feature, and certainly the Paramatma feature is there, described in the scripture. Here, Lord Brahma, because his service, the position that he has been given by Lord Vishnu is for creation, so he's seeing that form, the form of Garbhadakshayi Vishnu. And Yam Shyam Sundaram Achintya Guna Swarupam. With love, the devotee of Krishna sees the form of Krishna. And there's so many beautiful illustrations of the form of Krishna. And they see that two-handed form, Krishna holding his flute with cows and decorated with peacock feather and garland and so forth. They see that form. Just as the details from the end of the previous chapter, he's seeing a different form according to his contemplation, according to his mood and spirit. The Lord is very merciful. He's very merciful, and he's further elaborating on how he's so merciful. And texts 11 to 12 and 13 that follow are backpedaling a bit. It's describing the position of mixed devotion. Brahma is describing the mixed devotion of the demigods, because Lord Brahma is the forefather of even the demigods, who are then the forefathers of all living entities. He is recognizing their position as mixed. They have some hankering for the Lord, they have some hankering for some position, some distinction, some honor, some enjoyment, enjoying those things. So, on the devotional side, they make offerings to the Supreme Lord. And they contemplate Him. It is He who they are serving. So, Brahma says, that's always good, offer something even in a mixed position. That's always good. He says, such acts of religion never go in vain. But the pious activities of the people, such as the performance of Vedic rituals, charity, austerity, penances, and transcendental service performed with such a view to worship you and satisfy you by offering you the fruitive results, are also beneficial. Oh, that's even down a little bit further, the karma yoga. So, just like the yoga ladder, he's described in the previous verses, those that are unregulated. Then those that are regulated, they're following injunctions. Then there are those that actually do offerings to the Supreme, karma yoga. Then there are those that are in mixed devotion, bhakti yoga, but mixed with anticipation of enjoyment. Then is the verse that we're focusing on this morning. Text 14. Let me offer my obeisances unto the Supreme Transcendence, which is eternally distinguished by His internal potency. The word distinguished is used in a different way, but a very special way, like a mark of distinction. He has His internal potency. His indistinguishable, impersonal feature is realized by intelligence for self-realization. I offer my obeisances unto Him who, by His pastimes, enjoys the creation, maintenance, and dissolution of the cosmic manifestation. That's a very interesting collection of statements, three statements. The impersonal feature, the Purusha avatar feature, and the position of the internal potency. Because the process of creation for the Purusha avatars is also It's a function of the Supreme Lord's creative potency, and that the Supreme Lord has, his potency is all powerful. But there's this, the distinction of his internal potency and his external potency it's difficult to understand. Like this question, you mentioned it the other day, how does something material come from something spiritual? It's a mystery. So different people have different ways of looking at that. That something material comes from spiritual. The impersonalists say it doesn't, or it's not real. It's illusion. It doesn't even exist. It's false. And all that we need to do is recognize it's false, and voila, we're God. Just say it. I'm God. It's all one. Because all there is Brahman, because all this is false. Because you can't have matter coming from spirit. You have to call it false. It's false. Just say it, it's false. And then what's left is what's real. That's Brahman. And Brahman doesn't have any differentiation, because then you have two things. You can't have two things if all there is one thing. So there's only one thing. So it's false. Anything else is false. You can't have soul and God, because that's two things. You can't have matter and spirit, because that's two things. You can't have diversity of matter, because there's only one thing. That's like, the a priori assumption, so that's all there is. There's one thing. The Madhvacharya, challenged that one as far as you can challenge it. Dvaitavad, two. And he held up his fingers, and as he hammered or expounded on that teaching very, very elaborately. His system is called Panchabheda. There's five different kinds of twos. There's a distinction between God and the living entity. There's a distinction between the living entity and matter. There's a distinction between God and matter. There's a distinction between varieties of matter. Because Krishna declares it in Bhagavad Gita. Bhumirapolo vayu kamano buddhir eva cha ahamkara. There's eight. Bina prakritir ashtada. And there's a difference between living entity and living entity. Different living entities are individual. Panchabheda. And hammered it all the way. And on the authority of all the scriptures, not just Bhagavad Gita, but his Vedanta Sutra and everything. So he taught not all one. And the Bhagavatam here, this verse, is this impersonal feature. The language is interesting. His indistinguishable impersonal feature is realized by intelligence for self-realization. So the self, the soul, Atma, Brahman, Jiva, is of that spiritual energy, spiritual potency, spiritual status, and by intelligence, by the process of distinguishing matter and spirit, neti neti, not iti, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. By negation, spirit is not this. Brahman is, what is Brahman? It's not this. So what is it? It's not this. It's Brahman. There's no that no diversity position. So the indistinguishable, impersonal feature. Like chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita begins with Arjuna asking Krishna, which do you consider to be best? The worship of your impersonal feature or the worship of your personal feature? And Krishna, very clear question, and Krishna gives a very clear answer. The worship of my personal feature is best. Then he discusses the impersonal feature. To meditate, to fix your mind upon, the language here is the indistinguishable. Very challenging. That which has no qualities, that which has no form, that which has no features. How do you even think of what to speak of, fix your mind on it? Very difficult. Brahma is recognizing the difficulty, but he's also honoring those who are, have that capacity of discernment to realize the self. At least the self is distinct from matter. It's another entity. So many people can't. They don't have the capacity. And so the self is matter. That's all there is. That's mechanistic science. So if there's impersonalists, then there's everybody else. Tat-tat-evi tarojana, the people in general. That all there is matter. Well, then you get all these ideas that life is but a complex combination of matter. That's all it is. Once upon a time, there was a big bang, or once upon a time there was a primordial soup, and some lightning bolt. Don't ask me where the lightning bolt came from, where the primordial soup came from, but they were there, and some energy input into this primordial soup, and from this soup came little amino acids. Then a bunch of amino acids decided, hey, let's get together and form a living organism. Yay, that's okay. That's all a living organism is combinations of amino acids. And then those amino acids started to, become living entities. From a little molecule to a living organism. Yay, living organism. Then successive mutations over time by survival of the fittest rules. And so you get all this diversity, you got all kinds of stuff, but it all came from matter and combinations of matter. There's nothing more. The distinction between matter and spirit is not within the purview of such individuals. Little anecdote. When I was in high school, in my senior year of high school, a foreign exchange student came to stay in our home. Because it's American Field Service, AFS, so sometimes, someone went from our school and someone came from another school, and there's kind of like that. The AFS is a broker of people. You go to this school and so other people come to your school. So the person that came to stay in our home for 1 year, school year, was from Japan. His name was, still is, Ken Ujiri. He was brilliant. Brilliant. So we went back to Japan, and I didn't see him for some period of time, and I finally saw him after he had finished his third PhD. His first PhD was in mathematics. His second PhD was in physics. And his third PhD, which he did at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, was in biochemistry. Mathematics, physics, biochemistry. And he was going back to Japan. I was in New York, with the New York Temple. And he wanted to see me, and he wanted to visit the Statue of Liberty. Right? He was living in New York, but he'd never been to the Statue of Liberty because he just really wasn't interested. But, you know, so he came and stayed at the temple, and we were on a, I remember very clearly, on the subway ride going to the Statue of Liberty, and I asked him, what was it that your PhD was in? What was the field of study? He said, the cell division of frogs. What is it? Math, physics, and biochemistry that makes one cell become two cells? And I said, what if there's some spiritual principle, like the circumstances become right and the soul enters and the one cell becomes two cells? Supposing that was the answer to your research. He said it, he gave a very honest answer and a clear answer. It wasn't a fudgy answer. He said, as a scientist, we can't even consider that because it's not empirical. We can't measure it with our instruments. It's just, if that's the case, we can't even talk about it. So that's an honest answer. And then, because some, they would say, oh, rubbish. Some people would just say, that's ridiculous, because all there is matter. And laws that govern matter, and there isn't anything else. So I thought, either he's wasting his time completely, or I'm wasting my time completely. But I'm going to go with, you know, the Vedic conclusion, because that's Shabda Praman. And then the others are, you know, by inference and logic, or by sense examination, and the senses are imperfect. And logic and reason is also quite imperfect. But the perfect source is from the perfect person. So I'm going to say with Shabda Praman. It's so many other things of, like this discussion about we had yesterday morning about cloning, and but life comes from life. That's our experience. Besides what the Vedas say, life, you don't have life unless there's life. From life comes life. Which, aside from scripture, that's our experience. And then deductively, so life comes from life. Where does life come? It comes from life. Brilliant, huh? But to say, well, life comes from matter. Well, wait a minute. Where do we experience that? You know, the primordial soup. Like, can you do one? Here's some electricity and here's some soup. You know, or here's the elements make life. Or, you know, here's a singularity, make a big bang. So, but you want me to say, okay, that's how it happened. Yeah, I'm not ready to go there. Because my experience and common sense tells me life comes from life. Therefore, God. You know, but they don't want to go there. So it's a stalemate. Lord Brahma isn't in a stalemate position. He's very clear. So there is by intelligence, some persons can discern the indistinguishable impersonal feature. Distinguished, that this is the Lord, is distinguished by his internal potency, which is of another category than material energy. It's spiritual energy. It's his direct, and the other is his indirect. It's still his energy, so it's under his direction, but it's indirect. Maya jakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam. It's like the description in this earlier part of the third canto, and in the second canto, and throughout the Vedas, that in Sri Brahma Samhita, the Lord creates indirectly just by glancing. He doesn't directly contact. This is one of the distinctions between Lord Vishnu and Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. There are those that fall under the umbrella of Hinduism or consider themselves to be Hindu, although there's no such word in the Sanskrit dictionaries or the Vedic literature, but they consider themselves Hindu. And they consider there's three. Some consider there's so many, 33 million. But then there are those that say there's three. And of the three, two of them directly contact matter and one of them doesn't. That's Lord Vishnu. By his glance. He doesn't directly contact matter. He has glances over Pradhan. And Pradhan is a unique state of matter. It's undifferentiated, subtle totality of the material energy. He just glances at that Pradhan. The glance is called Shambhu. And the glance contacts Pradhan, or matter, and then it starts to differentiate. And with the glance, the living entities are carried by the glance. That's Shambhu. He carries the living entities, and then so like the Sri Brahma Samhita gives this comparison, like milk that's in touch with a souring agent, like tamarind or lemon or a souring agent, the milk becomes curd. So curd is nothing other than a transformation of milk. But it's not milk, it's curd. There's a distinction. It's milk in touch with a souring agent that now becomes curd. You can't make curd back into milk once it's curd. That's it. So, using that comparison, Lord Shiva is the curd. And Lord Vishnu is the uncurdled milk. That from which the curd comes. And the power of Shambhu is derived from the person from whom Shambhu comes. That before the glance, it's Vishnu. Lord Shiva's capacity to bring about destruction and whatever else he does is power derived from the source of power. So there's Shakti, power, and there's Shaktiman, the source of the power. And Vishnu Tattva is Shaktiman. So there's this internal, the verse, the sentence is, let me offer my obeisances unto the Supreme Transcendence, who is eternally distinguished by his internal potency. So Lord Shiva has internal potency. It's he doesn't depend on anyone else than himself, because it's his potency. And that's how he's distinguished. So we can say he's distinguished in the sense that different than Lord Shiva or Lord Brahma, he's unique in that he has his own internal potency. So that's one way of taking distinguished. Another way of taking distinguished is there are spiritual diversities that he possesses that others have material potencies, the transformed part. And then there's this impersonal feature that doesn't have potency, but it's emanation, the jyoti, Brahma jyoti, is emanation from Parabrahma, who has distinguishable characteristics by his internal potency. And then the last part of the verse is he, that form that I'm seeing before me now, Lord Vishnu, he has his rasa, where he's Lord Brahma is saying it's a leela of Lord Vishnu to do the activities of creation, maintenance, and destruction. In the purport I'm going to read, but I'll just say it ahead of time, Prabhupada is saying the internal potency of Krishna when he exhibits rasa is like the rasa dance where he's dancing with the gopis. That's his internal potency. Not only is distinguished by the gopis, it's he expands himself, so he dances with in between each of two gopis. I mean, who can do that? Besides, somebody can dance, but who can expand themselves in so many forms and dance with their own potency? We can dance with someone else, but not our own potency, because we don't have our own potency like Krishna has. And then, in comparison, Lord Vishnu, he's having rasa in a different way. He's having rasa by expanding the material potencies and making creations through the agency of Lord Brahma and Lord Vishnu, Lord Shiva. It's a lila. It says rasa, creation, maintenance, and dissolution. Very different. But it's a different function than Krishna's rasa dance. One is in the spiritual atmosphere, and the other is in the material atmosphere. Nice little verse, huh? Let me read the purport. The Supreme Lord is eternally distinguished from the living entities by his internal potency. Living entities don't have that internal potency. We don't enjoy our own potency. Because we're so tiny, we need something outside of ourselves. Supposing we're hungry, or supposing we want a friend. We want some companionship. We need another entity for that companionship. But Krishna doesn't. He just expands himself. Or he expands his internal potency and voila. He's got Mother Jasoda, he's got Nanda Maharaj, he's got the gopis, he's got the cowherd boys and monkeys and cows and Madhu Mangal and the river Jamuna and peacocks and the whole show. But it's his internal potency. So, living entities don't have that. Krishna has that. He's distinguished by his internal potency. The Supreme Lord is eternally distinguished from the living entities by his internal potency, although he is also understood in this impersonal feature by self-realized intelligence. So what's that? There are persons that aren't inclined to devotional service, but you know they're inclined to transcendence. Some. And some of those have the capacity to understand the impersonal Brahman. It's something like the verse of Bhagavad Gita. Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschid yatati siddhaye yatatamapi siddhanam kaschin mambeti tatvataha. You know that one? Manushyanam. Manu. Manu is man. So how strange you, out of many millions of men, maybe you'll find one, maybe not two, but maybe you'll find one who's endeavoring for siddha, perfection. Then, out of many who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. So that siddha, or that perfection, is one of the perfections, is this distinction between matter and spirit. And very clearly understand, my identity falls in this realm of spirit. Aham Brahmasmi. And I've realized it. Perfection, siddha. I'm distinct from matter, and I realize it, and I... part of the difficulty is, how do you live your life like that? Because life is, you know, this one. How do you live your life? Go and live in a cave and do nothing. Chant Om. And read Vedanta Sutra. And be peaceful, shanti. However, our nature is, we want love. We want relationships of love. And so leave that position and come back to this position. If one hasn't taken shelter of the internal potency that connects one to the person, of personality of Godhead. But Prabhupada is saying, because Brahma is saying, there are those that have intelligence enough to understand the impersonal aspect, and they worship the impersonal aspect. The rasa dance, devotees of the Lord therefore offer all respectful obeisances unto the impersonal feature of the Lord, recognizing that it's an indication of the person from whom the impersonal feature comes. So we don't disrespect, we respect the impersonal feature. Not that it's all in all. Or we certainly don't say, as the Mayavadis say, God has no features. He has no hands, he has no face, he has no personality, he has no qualities. He's, you know, really slow. He's blind, deaf, dumb, and crippled. We don't say that. So we're not Mayavadis, but offering devotees of the Lord, like Lord Brahma here, therefore offer respectful obeisances unto the impersonal feature of the Lord. The word rasa in this verse is significant. Rasa is used to say it's the rasa of Vishnu that he does creation. It's pastime. The rasa dance is performed by Lord Krishna in the company of the cowherd damsels at Vrindavan. And the personality of Godhead Garbhadakshai Vishnu is engaged in the rasa enjoyment with his external potency, in which he creates, maintains, and dissolves the entire material manifestation. Indirectly, Lord Brahma offers his respectful obeisances unto Lord Sri Krishna, who is factually ever engaged in rasa enjoyment with the gopis, as confirmed in the Gopala Tapani Upanishad, in the following words. Prarardhante so buddhayata gopa vesho me purusha parastat avirbha bhuva. So prarardhante, prararda is a half of Brahma's life. There's two prarardas in his day. So during the life of Brahma, so buddhyata gopavesho me, gopavesha, the appearance of a gopa, cowherd boy, Krishna. Krishna, he's gopa. Gopal Kumar or Gopal, he's a cowherd boy, Gopalesha. May Purusha, he's the supreme, is a person, a Purusha enjoyer. He's an enjoyer of his pastimes as the cowherd boy. Last part of the purport. The distinction between the Lord and the living entity is definitely experienced when there is sufficient intelligence to understand his internal potency as distinguished from the external potency by which he makes possible the material manifestation. So, two things in conclusion. Wow, it's almost 8 o'clock. We can't make a cosmic manifestation. We can't create matter, we can't create life. We can manipulate matter to make stuff. We can make stuff that resembles that which has been created by the Creator. One of Buddy Narayan Prabhu's favorite little stories is when one of the wonders of engineering was the creation of the longest suspension bridge in the world, the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. And the engineers that, I don't know for a fact, but he says this over and over again, so I'll repeat it. What the technology that they used was based upon years of studying spider webs. So spiders didn't go to engineering school. They just have intelligence to build spider webs. And the engineers studied the spider webs and then figured out how to build the Bay Bridge. So where does the intelligence of the spiders come from? Same place the intelligence of the engineers come from. From the original Creator. Same as Prahlad said to Hiranyakashipu when asked, where are you getting your power from? I'm the most powerful and I can't even touch you, can't harm you at all. And Prahlad's answer was, I'm getting my power from the same place you are. From Vishnu. So, living entities derive power from Vishnu. And Vishnu is the one who is taking care of the creation of the universe, which we can't do, but we can create something, a little something. And by mystic power, there's a mystic power, one can create a planet or destroy a planet. There's a particular mystic city. But supposing someone could destroy a planet, create a planet. Look at all the planets. You know, let's give credit to the one who created all the planets and is going to dissolve all the planets. Instead of, by mystic power, one could make one or make one disappear. If they had such mystic development. It goes to what's the source of everything. So Brahma's got to this job of creating the universe. So he's not under illusion, thinking, I'm the creator of the universe. He's deriving power from one who is the creator of the universe. And that one who has the power to create the universe, from whom he's deriving the power to assist him, has the power to have his internal potency, where eternal lila is going on, where internal potency rasa is taking place. So he's not bewildered by his material activities. The relevance specifically to us is we get bewildered by material activities. We think that we're the doer. And that's not right. We're not. There is one who is, and we're the instrument It can be the instrument in illusion, or it can be the instrument in consciousness of who's the real controller. And that entity, that supreme entity, has his internal potency, where he does things not like we do things. His enjoying in the spiritual world is not like our imitating his enjoying in the spiritual world, within the material world. Our ball dancing, as Prabhupada calls it, you know, the boy-girl program, the male-female enjoyment program, is not at all comparable to, it's a dim, perverted reflection of the spiritual reality. And one who can focus their attention upon the spiritual reality, as Brahma has the capacity, he's appreciating the internal potency and the capacity of the Supreme Lord through his manipulating his external potency to bring about creation. And I, Lord Brahma, am but a little instrument of that Supreme. May I be protected from the false ego of thinking I'm the creator of this universe. And for us, may we be protected from the false ego of thinking, you know, whatever the application of whatever, you know, our level of whatever it is that we're doing, that we're doing. I'm a grade A student. I get the honor roll every time because I'm such a gifted student. That's for these two guys. And then, you know, whatever else. That applies to any one of us. I'm a da-da-da. It's illusion. We certainly exist, but whatever it is that we're capable of doing, the capacity for doing that is derived from the energetic source. Let us honor that energetic source. Let us engage in devotional service to that energetic source. Let us be instruments of the will of that energetic source, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By that submission unto him, we're entering into the domain of the internal potency, and go further and further into the domain of the internal potency, and intimacy increases, and realization increases, and our love for the Personality of Godhead increases, and the particular enjoyment of rasa and activity with the Personality of Godhead increases. It's a progressive, gradual, progressive exchange. Nice verse, huh? Any discussion? It's 8 o'clock already. Yeah.
This might be a frequently asked question on this section, but in the point where that's what you're making, that Lord Brahma is praying to be protected from the false ego of the immature, and then Krishna assures him after this that yes, you won't be attacked by the mode of passion even in your process of creation. But then I believe it's after this that he gets kind of bewildered by chasing Mother Saraswati, his daughter. I was wondering if after Krishna assured him that he will not be bewildered by the mode of passion, how is it that later on
he was protected? Kshipram bhavati dharmatma. He was protected.
So he was protected from what?
He was brought back to his senses. He was protected. That's, you know, how might we be protected? Because Krishna gives the same promise. How might we be protected? So here we are, and here comes a tsunami. You know, here comes some horrible event that's impacting us, how are we protected? That that's something external, not just something internal, but something that whether external or internal, Krishna's protection is there. He brings us to Him. Dadami Pudyogam Tam. That's His protection. So we're not infallible. But Krishna is infallible, and His quality of commitment. Yesterday evening, the topic was Krishna's quality as Bhakta Vatsala. He extends that affection and protection to His loving devotee. So they may externally, internally be in some difficult situation, and Krishna protects them. He corrects the situation, internally or externally. So alone, we're in a very, very perilous situation, protected, we're safe. Doesn't mean we should be cavalier and frivolous, but even if apichet sudaracharo bhajate mamanyabha sadhureva samantavya chipram bhavati dhamma, Krishna's protection is there. Something else?
Maharaj, when we achieve some success, it's usually we were told to say, offer the glories to Parampara and Krishna. So what should we react? What should be our approach when we are in kind of not so good situation?
The opposite, no?
Yeah, we don't really say all glories to Prabhupada when we are.
Why not? I know people that are in very severely challenging circumstances, and it's Krishna, you're kind. Now that takes an advanced devotee to think like that, but it takes an advanced devotee to think the other way too, because we like praise, we like honor, we like distinction, we like, and that's a contamination. So it takes one who's pure to not fall prey to that contamination.
But it seems that we have to cultivate it to purify ourselves.
Sure. Bhakti is a sort of cultivation. Anushilana. That's bhakti. We're cultivating. Because we're not there, we have contamination. We want and not that. Because we want to be the enjoyers rather than Krishna as the enjoyer. That's the root of our contamination. So Krishna places us into a very, very nice example of this, very nice example from the Bhagavatam, is Valmiki Maharaj. At the end of the whole Leela, Lord Vamana, in his full dwarf size, stands up and says, "Just see how Bali Maharaj is so incredible. I just wanted to show the world how incredible." Because he was put into difficulties by me that were so severe that no one could survive them. And I even called them bad names. Said, he's adharmic. It's not true, he says. He's fully dharmic. But I said he's adharmic. And still he didn't depart from the truth. Just see. Oh. Even in adversity, Krishna is very kind. Don't depart from the truth, the real position of shelter. Krishna is giving me an opportunity to take exclusive shelter of Him. All my false shelters have been taken away. Or Queen Kunti. Bring on the calamities again and again, because when there's calamities we have no other shelter. We feelingly call out to you and you come. Now that there's apparently no calamity, You're going. So better have the calamity. You stay. That's unique consciousness. It's not ordinary consciousness. We're not to imitate. But when adverse circumstances come, it's a great opportunity. And it's Krishna's mercy. In the purport of that verse, where Vamana is glorifying Bali, Prabhupada explains, sometimes Krishna will put his devotee into such difficulty, there's no other shelter. But Krishna will also give the devotee the strength to take no other shelter when their heart is pure. Not only to endure the difficulty, but to stay steadfast in the position of shelter. Krishna gives that strength. Krishna is very kind. Krishna is very, is in all circumstances, bhaktivatsala, very kind. Just varieties of kindness. Maybe not the ones that we would pick, but varieties of kindness. Anything else? You got something?
No, like Krishna expands Sadhguru in his internal potency to enjoy the Rasa Leela.
And all of his pastimes, sure.
So, like, I'm kind of confused, like, I mean, we are also fragmental portions of, part and parcels of Krishna.
Yes.
So, how does that fit in, like,
This is similar to the question that Dwarkadish asked yesterday. And the answer will be similar to yesterday's answer. We are part and parcel of the Supreme, in that sense we're qualitatively one. However, there's distinction. Not only we're tiny, he's unlimitedly great. We are Shakti of him, of Purusha. We're Prakriti, Paraprakriti, but we're Prakriti, and he's Purusha. He's in another category. So we don't have the capacity to expand our energies because we're energy. And he has the capacity because he's energetic and he can expand his energies. So there's the distinction part. So while bearing in mind the sameness or oneness part, also bear in mind the difference part. And they're simultaneous. Should I say it again in a different language, just to make it extra clear? We want to enjoy because we're part and parcel of the Supreme, who is all enjoyment. Because we're tiny and because we're energy, not energetic, our enjoyment is in the form of something outside of ourselves. So we try to acquire or possess or steal or, you know, somehow get something that's not mine and make it mine by illusion. It's mine and now I'm the enjoyer of that. But it's something outside of myself. Imitation of the Supreme, who doesn't need anything outside of himself. He just expands his potency, internal and external potency. And we're marginal, we're another potency. So what's our raison d'etre, what's our purpose of life? It's why do we exist? We're parts and parcel of the Supreme existing for his enjoyment. It's not that once upon a time Krishna was alone and said, gee, I'm lonely. It'd be really nice to have some friends. Boop! And then some living entities manifested. Not like that. But we wrap, so it's not a chronological coming into being, but rather a existential existence. Our existence is expansions of Krishna, the marginal potency of Krishna, qualitatively like him, for his enjoyment. Because he's really expert at everything, including enjoyment. So we exist for his enjoyment. In love. But with love entails some freedom to say yes or no. And yet, love is yes. And no is also an option. Otherwise it isn't love. It's force. So there's an option. Our existence is in relation to Krishna's enjoyment, expanding the already unlimited happiness of the unlimited, which can be a daunting service to do, but it works because is that unlimited increases unlimitedly. So it's that seeming obstacle is taken away. It's a dynamic of love. Go back to your question. Supposing we say no. We can't just expand our potency and then have residence. we don't have that, we're not the potent, we're the potency. So then we have to go and grab a hold of some of the other potency and try to become the enjoyer of the other potency. We have to become thieves and, you know, etc. Enjoyers of another's property. But Krishna doesn't have to do that. And there's the distinction. If it's difficult to understand, Prabhupada, in explaining this topic, again and again and again and again, you know, expressed that the difficulty in understanding these things has to do with the very fact that we're in the material world, which is we want to be God. So to be God, the distinction between us and God isn't clear. Has to be not clear. Otherwise, he's the master, I'm the servant. So if that starts to blur, then I can be the enjoyer. So blur it is. And we try to understand the distinction between us and the Supreme. It's, you know, conceptually difficult because we have a fundamental disposition that's opposed to that. That's where the problem is. Not, you know, our intelligence needs to become sharper. Yes, it needs to become sharper, but the obstacle for that is something more fundamental. Our opposition to Krishna being the Supreme, because we want to be Purusha. That's why it's difficult. That primordial spirit of Ishwara Bhav, when we're not Ishwara. We're Prakriti. We're enjoyed. That's what we're meant for. You have a problem with that. I want to be an enjoyer. I want to try to become God conscious. I want to take that baggage with me into the spiritual realm. And you have to leave it outside. No shoes inside. It stays outside. No dirty laundry. You leave it outside. You want to come in and put the association of Krishna. Yes?
So the only place that we, the living entities, can find actual enjoyment is from enjoying Krishna's enjoyment?
Yeah. That's what real enjoyment is, and anything other than that is a reflection. And the reflection isn't, there's no substance in the reflection. It may look like, here's an apple, here's a mirror, there's an apple, but there's no substance. It looked like, there's no substance. Insubstantial. So the real enjoyment is Krishna's enjoyment. And we connect with Krishna's enjoyment, and that's real enjoyment. Everlasting, undying, primordial.
So what do you do if you're in the position of not, you know, seeing that the material world isn't real enjoyment, you know, it's temporary and it's...
Then you suffer. That's what happens. That's what your question was, what happens? You suffer.
And so what do you do then if you're...
Well, we don't like to suffer, so we want to, like, you know, take an aspirin or something. Do something so the suffering is diminished. So we just like keep trying to adjust things. Commonly. Try a different approach. You know, very, very determined to get enjoyment by shuffling with an unending series of manipulations of circumstances to get enjoyment. So, when we're fortunate, Brahmanda Brahmite Kona Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasadivai Bhakti Lata Beach. You know that verse, yeah? Brahmanda is a universe. Brahmite Kona, that living entity who is journeying, sojourning, wandering. Brahmanda, Brahmite Kona, Bhagyavan Jeev, the living entity Jeev, that becomes Bhagyavan. There's Bhagavan, and there's Bhagyavan, one who receives the mercy of Bhagavan. Fortunate. Living entity. Guru Krishna Prasadi by the combined mercy of Guru and Krishna, Bhakti Lata Bija. Bija means seed. And Bhakti Lata is the creeper of Bhakti. One receives the seed of the creeper of Bhakti. So the awakening of the disposition to find happiness in Krishna's happiness. By the combined mercy of Guru and Krishna, then that awakens. At least the potential is there, that we are to carefully cultivate the seed. That can, when the creeper of bhakti, when it grows and grows and grows and grows, takes us to the lotus feet of Krishna. Manifesting in the mature stage of the flowers and then the fruits, the bhava and the prema of love for Krishna. So way down here, just the seed, just an attraction. Even as, you know, it's not just a head thing, a conceptual thing, a heart thing, that I find happiness in thinking of Krishna's happiness and acting for Krishna's happiness. I find happiness in that. Let me nurture that seed. One is very fortunate. Bhagyavan Jeev, who received that mercy, the awakening of that primordial, you know, inner self happiness, contentment. Very fortunate. And then, so then cultivating that continuing association, and the continuing association in part is the instructions received, and then we take shelter in the instructions. We make the instructions one with our heart, one with our life, and we make further advancement. That's a form of association. Sadhu Sangha. More, or you're okay? More thoughts on the topic? Good for now.
Okay.
Yes.
One of the propensities of human beings, in addition to enjoying, is to also learn.
Sure. Sat, Chit, and Ananda. We want to live forever. Mm-hmm. Protection and defense is something we all share too. We want to live forever. And learning, expanding our capacity for knowledge, universal. Doesn't matter what culture, doesn't matter. Even form of life.
So what is the core of that? What is that, the source of that?
And it's our constitutional nature.
Okay.
Sat, Chit. We want to restore that Chit. But, you know, where do we look? Depends on the conception of life that we carry. We'll look there. The mode of nature that we're conducted by, we'll look there.
So then it reaches the highest level, it's dovetailed again to Krishna.
Well, one is you offer the mode of nature propensity that you have to Krishna. That was something that Narada said. That never goes in vain. But real pursuit of education or regaining our position of full knowledge is to repose that propensity upon the Supreme, because that's perfect knowledge. So go to Krishna. He's the best teacher. You want knowledge. You want education. You go to a teacher. Go to the best teacher. Let me repose that propensity upon Krishna. Therefore, Krishna, one of the statements in the end of the Bhagavad Gita, those who study the sacred conversation are worshipping me with their intelligence. What's the... You know, one way is the ascending. Let me figure out what Krishna says. Then there's the descending. What is that gift that Krishna wants to give? It's something like the answer or the response that I gave to Manohar. What kind of intelligence is required when you chant? It's receiving. But according to what Krishna said, what the Bhagavatam says about Yajanti hi sumedha saha, those who have sufficient intelligence in this age of Kali, sumedha saha, the best of intelligence, they engage in sankirtan. Oh, how's that a sign of intelligence? Like, intelligence, I thought, is you know stuff. I know this, I know that, I know the other thing. I'm a professor of many subjects. I'm a very learned fellow. I'm the dean. I'm the department chairman of three different departments. I have many other learned fellows that are under me, and they all look up to me as the most learned. That's me. And I don't chant. And then there's the person that's just chanting. And how they sumedha. So the capacity is not the capacity of intellectual acumen. The capacity is receiving the highest truth. And one who has received the highest truth becomes the knower of things that the person with intellectual acumen will never understand. That's the... And similarly, the study of Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita is not dependent upon intellectual acumen. It doesn't hurt, but it can if I have a hard heart. Then I can't, I'm thinking I'm trying to barge my way into a private place. I don't have a password. I don't have a mentality. So I come up with something else that's not the gift that's being given, the knowledge that's being imparted. I come up with something else. So it's that same receiving mode out of devotion and love. And the devotion of love, so it doesn't mean shut your intelligence off. But use that like our great acharyas. Jiva Goswami was such a luminary, and so many of them. And details and details and details and details and details and details and details. Whoa. Did they have intellect? But it was with the one in front, not a zero and zero, zero and zero and zero and zero and so many zeros. The commentary of our acharyas on all these technical things, it's astounding. You know, they didn't, oh, that's too technical. I just want to chant. Details and details in their commentary. They, you know, they saw how the Lord Brahma, how to fit a universe together. Like Prabhupada said, let them make one mosquito. And he didn't just make one mosquito. He made a whole universe. How brilliant. What an engineer. He didn't have to go to spider school. He just, you know, became a pure devotee. He knew how to make spiders that made spider webs. Etc. But so it's a different acumen, a different capacity. Capacity of devotion. And then Krishna gave him all knowledge. There wasn't a school to go to. Wasn't a professor to study under. Weren't textbooks. It was just darkness and a lotus flower. And the syllables, tapa. And he got it. But yeah, another feature of his getting it was his apprehension that I may go down the path of thinking I did it, instead of I received it and now I'm an instrument of the one from whom I received. That's intelligence, avoiding the pitfalls of being trapped in material conceptions and everything that flows from material conceptions. Anyone else? Let's see if those that haven't spoken yet. Anything? You're okay. Okay.
Just to piggyback on that, it was really nice explanation, Maharaj. And I was thinking, like you mentioned about Lord Brahma, he just did the tapa, and because he was a pure devotee, he knew how to put together the whole universe. I just wanted to hear your comments. It seems like in the devotee circles, we kind of swing on the spectrum between, you know, all we need is devotional service and we'll understand everything, to the other side is people are, you know, they're finding that, oh, there's all these, you know, they read different books and they apply that in devotional service. So I was wondering, what is the balancing back to guide it through that kind of one of those spectrums of faith?
I think a lot depends on one's faith. I know what I have personally greater faith in. Everything is here. I don't have a problem with taking something that's from other sources and Krishnaizing it, except when it comes to, we'll put it this way, only those who have a strong digestive power, like strong digestive power, should take that stuff and digest it, assimilate it, and present. And others that don't have that capacity shouldn't, because that then becomes their religion. You know, their faith goes away from descending and becomes the other kind. And with it comes pride and, you know, mistakes and things. That's just a general perspective. Certainly it's helpful to take things, whatever is going to help enhance one's bhakti. Not just, you know, to do a thing better, but that which is going to enhance one's bhakti. Because then you put the tool in the hand of one who has bhakti, and zoom, zoom, he's able to do nice things. But what minus, or where bhakti is not so strong, it can be harmful. Besides, look like it's being helpful. There's details, but that's like a broad stroke. Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.